From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In 1857, U.S. President James Buchanan unseated Mormon leader Brigham Young as governor of the Utah Territory. Buchanan had become suspicious of Young's leadership and suspected it amounted to little more than a theocracy. So he sent troops into the territory to assert U.S. power in the Great Basin. The military showdown has come to be called the Utah War or the Mormon Rebellion, and the authors of a new book say, for the most part, the way the story is told today is just plain wrong, a manufactured history, they call it. So today in the program, the historians Will Bagley and David Bigler will join us to clear up the history as they see it. We invite you to join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In 1857, U.S. President James Buchanan unseated Mormon leader Brigham Young as governor of the Utah Territory. Buchanan had become suspicious of Young's leadership and suspected it amounted to a little more than a theocracy. So he sent troops into the territory to assert U.S. power in the Great Basin. That's the story that most school kids will read, anyone else reads for that matter. But according to historians that are joining us today, the story is wrong. It's a manufactured history, they say. The way the story is usually told is that U.S. troops came to persecute long-suffering Mormon saints and that the settlers used their wits to defy and defeat the tyrannical federal government. It's a good story. The authors of a new book say there's a problem. It's not how it happened. Not exactly, anyway. They're joining us today to talk about what they say is the true facts of the Mormon Rebellion. We invite you to join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Will Bagley is with us, an independent historian who specializes in Utah and the American West. He's the editor of the 12-volume series Kingdom in the West, The Mormons and the American Frontier. And Will Bagley, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Good to be here.
David Bigler is with us, former director of the Utah Board of State History. Among his books is A Winter with the Mormons, the 1852 letters of Jotham Goodall. Did I pronounce that right?
Goodell.
Goodell. The Mormon Rebellion is Bigler and Bagley's third book together. They'll be giving a readings this week in Salt Lake City, and we'll give you details about those as we go along. So I want to start with Will Bagley, you first. You say in the book that the details of the so-called Mormon War, the Mormon Rebellion, it's become a myth. That the story that has come to us is, I think you describe it as a mythic hero tale. What's the story that a school kid would read or hear about in Utah? And I guess even today they'll hear it this way.
Well, the U.S. government, based on the reports of malicious officials who were simply anti-Mormons, preemptorily, without any investigation, dispatched the United States Army to Utah to replace Governor Young and ignored the fact that the Mormons had been rock-solid citizens forever. The facts are much more complicated because we see this as very much a political conflict between the religious community, the Mormon theocracy that Brigham Young had established in Salt Lake, which was quite authoritarian, and the American Republic, which was a bottom-up operation as opposed to Mormon Society, which was a top-down operation. And so the two were basically incompatible, and the officials who had been repeatedly insulted in Salt Lake and defied, and their power had been ignored. The power of federal law, for instance, was completely diminished. And people passing through, people like Jotham Goodell, and people who stayed for, say, the winter, would run into this what they considered an un-American society, where they were often very severely, for want of a better word, persecuted. So, in fact, we believe that Buchanan was in a political situation where he had to do something to assert federal authority in an American territory.
Now, we're going to go through that, how that sort of played out. But I want to stay for a moment with the way the story has come to us, how it became a myth. David Bigler, talk a little bit about that. You say in the book that after decades of silence, on the subject, that after this all played out, that people kind of kept quiet about what had exactly happened, and that you say that Mormon historians began to claim, eventually, they began to claim the episode as their own, as you say in the book. And in the process, they, you say they changed it from a contentious struggle between the American Republic and a frontier theocracy into something else, into this myth. Explain that.
Rather than see it as it was, take an honest understanding of it, they moved to protect Brigham Young. And in order to do that, they had to make the goat of the whole episode the President of the United States, James Buchanan. So in history, in the histories that have been written, James Buchanan is designated, the episode is called Buchanan's Blunder.
Blunder, right.
So you see this phrase constantly in histories of Utah. The fact is that the blunder was Brigham Young's. And if you want to look for the blunders that were made in this whole episode, dating back several years before, you'd find him at the center of them.
Did the historians who touched this story up, did they distort it, twist it, or were there outright lies in the way they came to tell the story?
There were not outright lies that I'm aware of. They just changed the emphasis. They just put the good guys on one side and the bad guys on the other. And when, in fact, Buchanan always treated the Mormons with respect. When he sent the army and a new governor to replace Brigham Young, he did not do it in a mean kind of way. In so doing it, however, he started the country's first civil war, and he also owns the distinction of not being able to stop the nation's great civil war four years later.
Will Begley, the context of civil war is an important theme in this book. As David said, this was the first one, and I guess the struggle that came to certainly Abraham Lincoln later was, what do I do with a group of people who have different ideas about sovereignty, different ideas about their relationship with the federal government, and want to go off and be by themselves?
It's important to look at this event in the context of the crisis of the Union.
Yeah.
The American Union is falling apart over the issue of slavery. And one of the arguments allegedly presented, well, it was presented by a son of John Tyler, the president, was that, well, everybody in the country is going to unite in a crusade against the Mormons. Now, I don't think that was foremost in Buchanan's mind, but he was a politician, and that looked like it had some possible unifying factor. In fact, what happens is the Southern officers in the military, and it's not Johnston's army, it's Uncle Sam's army that comes to Utah. The Southern officers see that the Union will not forcefully back its army in a move like what happens in the Utah confrontation. And they begin to see that their complaints about the inequities in government income and how it's distributed and all the rest are reflected in the failures that take place in Utah, because Buchanan, after his resolve, which he carries through to his address to Congress and his message to Congress in December 1857, he's very forceful. He says, "The path of duty compelled me to take these actions." But after that, he's much more accommodating, and he just wants to defuse the crisis. The economy's collapsed in September of 1857. There's a huge depression going on. There's no money to finance this major operation to Utah. So Buchanan issues an ultimatum to Brigham Young, which is, we'll give everybody a pardon, otherwise face the music. The Mormons capitulate, accept the pardon for treason and other bad acts. And Buchanan then begins.
There's a sigh of relief from Buchanan, I'm guessing, probably. He doesn't want this to be a grand conflict.
And he's got in place a tower of jello named Alfred Cumming, who is terrified. and has seen some very nasty things happen. And he does everything.
And the nasty things in the territory.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he does everything to accommodate Brigham Young, who is probably slipping him. Well, we know that he's feeding him cash and other incentives to side with the Mormons. But what's interesting, you asked about the history,
yeah.
And the Mormons really don't say anything about this till the 1880s. And then in their juvenile publications for kids, they begin repeating the Lot Smith story about burning the wagon trains. And they put a real—
Say that story, because some people may not know it.
In late September, Lot Smith, who is a old Mormon firebrand, and he's not that old. He's quite young. He was the youngest member of the Mormon battalion. And he is up harassing the federal supply trains. And on two separate wagon trains, they burn close to 100 wagons and deprive the army of tons of supplies. They don't burn the winter coats, which would have been a real disaster. But Lot Smith, around this story of burning the wagon train, an immense lore builds up. And this, of course, doesn't play well back east, yeah. Where the Mormons have attacked federal U.S. Army. So it has a real mixed effect on the war. But to the Mormons, it becomes a hero story. And then you have the story of Porter Rockwell running off the mules from the army at South Pass.
It makes the federal troops look like Keystone Cops.
Yes. And in fact, none of this happened. Well, the burning of the wagons, that happened. But that story is suppressed. I found one source, and I don't mention it, I should have mentioned it in the book, by a Frenchman who in 1863, Louis Bertrand, publishes his account of the Utah War. And in it, the Mormons spare the army because they could have obliterated them. And there's a very hostile, very different set of how the story is told in 1863. It's told in French, so nobody notices. But the Mormons really begin rebuilding this story in the 1880s, and they do tell it, as most peoples will in their history, like the Texans have done and others, or the South does after the Civil War.
With the spin.
They make it a hero story.
You say that today, in the book, you say, David Bigler, anyone who challenges the faith-promoting history of the church, more broadly, in particular the story as well, is branded anti-Mormon, which you say pigeonholes their work and stifles open debate. So in some ways, this is a bigger story here in that sense. That's something that seems to disturb you, that when you sort of challenge the myth, not only are you what you're called anti-Mormon, I guess. That seems to bother you.
I found from my personal experience that when you approach these subjects with a clear intent not to harm or to be negative, but to be positive and tell the story correctly and accurately, the Mormons today are anxious to know this history, anxious to know what actually happened and receive it in a favorable way. Now, my work has been done over a period of many years. My main book, Forgotten Kingdom, The Mormon Theocracy in the American West, was well received by Mormon and non-Mormon readers alike. And it brings out the truth, but it does it in a way that people understand that I respect and admire Mormon culture today and understand it then, and I do not approach it from a negative anti-Mormon bias.
Let me get at that then, but both of you, have you respond to this? Because it seems the critique that surely will come to it, and already has. I read one critique from a Morgan Dean, the Association of Mormon Letters, says the book lacks balance, that it lacks context, offers sort of false dichotomies. And one of the false dichotomies is he says that there's this one-dimensional view that you offer of Brigham Young, and for that matter of James Buchanan. Young is a tyrant, Buchanan who has this selfless ambition. He detects this language in the book that I wanted you to respond to. He says that you call the Mormon settlers and leaders variously schemers, witch burners, Orwellian, delusional, fanatic, menacing, sinister. The Mormon opponents you describe as selfless, as courageous, as peacemakers, as hospitable. He says you don't really sympathize with the Mormon experience, and that those who sympathized with the Mormons of the time you present as buffoons or dupes. Now, there's a lot there. But David Bigler, you said you don't offer a negative view of Mormons. Those who have – this Morgan Deans in particular would say that you do offer quite a negative view of Mormons in that time.
I suppose I can understand how he feels, but I think it's a rather knee-jerk reaction. When you have truth, final, absolute, eternal, you like to believe it's the same today, yesterday, today, and tomorrow. And if it isn't, you become very upset. And I think there are some who feel that way. My own opinion is that most Mormons do not feel threatened by this history, nor should they feel threatened by it, and they want to know the truth about what happened. Our book is honest. It's complete. It's comprehensive. It is consistent. So that there, when I say consistent, I mean that events fall in a natural place, in a pattern that forms a picture that where everything works, fits together.
But Will Bagley, you don't have much good to say about Brigham Young. Is that an unfair way of describing your perception of Brigham Young in this book?
Well, I think if you look at the character sketch of Brigham Young, it starts out by acknowledging what a powerful and effective leader he was. But when you look at the actual acts of that leadership, he is not a Democrat. He is not a man of the people. He puts money well ahead of the interests of his congregation. And I am probably the leading critic of Brigham Young among Western historians. But what I have learned about Brigham Young over time has not been an inspiring picture. For instance, I summarize our research on hand cards. And what I was actually proposing to
Say what you mean by the hand cards. You're talking about his immigration scheme that he has come up with.
You think it was a scheme?
Well, I shouldn't use the word scheme. His idea, yeah.
It was a scheme.
I don't mean to
No, but I, you know, that wonderful example of quoting out of context, if I'd have done that to the review of a Mormon book, they'd be crying context. And he cries context. But those are, I don't recall who we called selfless. But it was no doubt
selfless ambition was the word you used, a term you used apparently for Buchanan, which I think this fellow is saying was that's also isn't exactly a nuanced view of him. I mean, it's not the tyrant versus the selfless president. See what I'm saying? That's what he's saying.
Well, selfless ambition is an odd term to begin
with. Okay, well,
I'm not sure.
I was just mentioning that somehow there was a false dichotomy, and I wanted you to respond to it. I do want to ask you this because I want to move to the story itself, but I want to get this out of the way because it is important. One of the most provocative things about your premise in the book is this connection you make to the Utah War and the events of 9/11. September 11th, 2001. Now explain this to me because you seem to be comparing the threat from Islamic fundamentalists who you say to what you say is this Mormon theocracy. Now some are going to take that as incredibly provocative. So I want to have you explain it because it's a premise that you lay out early on in the book. David Bigler.
Our premise is that theocratic systems and democratic systems can live together or one within the other without warfare, without conflict. The truth that they claim will not allow that. The superiority of the truth they claim must prevail. Truth prevails. It does not coexist or compromise. So we see that same spirit among Mormons of an earlier period, this zealousness. And we see the same spirit in militant Muslim. Now, this is identifying a militant Muslim, and we know that all Muslims are not militant, but only an arm of that religion. But people who will cut heads off and people who will blow themselves up are showing themselves to be very extreme in their religious views. And we're saying that some of the things we have learned from this Mormon history of the Utah Rebellion seem to be applicable today in the way we deal with this specific kind of fundamentalist Muslim.
One of the things you say in the book is you don't just pin this on leaders. You say that that rank and file Mormons themselves were also responding to the rhetoric that we're hearing over the pulpit, and that they themselves were fanatic.
Well, you take the Mountain Meadows Massacre.
Yeah.
Here you have as many as 70 men, husbands, God-fearing men, fathers of children, the last men in the world you would expect to commit an atrocity like this, and yet they do. And I think on orders they do.
So you're saying that the reason this is important is because of Islamic extremism. But you're not suggesting, Will Bagley, that a relative handful of extremists determined to spread their religious ideas represent – you're saying that represents a real threat. But you aren't making the connection that early Mormons represented the same kind of threat, are you? I mean, I just – what are you expecting when people read this connection that you're making between Al-Qaeda is extreme and Mormon settlers in the Great Basin.
What can we draw from this?
Yes. Well, what kind of reaction are you expecting? It's a pretty provocative connection that you're making, is it not?
I think you're drawing it too starkly.
Okay.
Because our thesis is, as David said, theocracy and Republican governments don't coexist. But Republican governments, especially the American government, by its nature, has a very hard time responding to a religious opposition. And the one thing that you see throughout this episode is how much deference the federal government gave to the Mormons because of their religion. The orders to the authorities, the federal officials, and the U.S. Army were, don't mess with their religion. And we've seen in the reaction to 9/11, there's this tremendous sense that, as David expressed, we don't want to blame all Muslims, but we do want to blame the extremists. And within the federal government's response to the Mormons, they had a hard time sorting out what that difference was. So I think that the thesis that the republics are not well equipped to deal with a threat from a theocracy.
Well said.
But theocracies are paper tigers. And every time Brigham Young is challenged where the federal government says, no, you're either going to accept this pardon for treason or you'll face the consequences. And that is literally the message that Brigham Young gets in March of 1858. And what does he do? He folds his tent. Immediately, this is a very harsh statement, but Winston Churchill said about a certain European nation that they were either at your throat or at your feet. And that's Brigham Young. And when you stand up to a bully, what happens? They collapse. And Brigham Young, as I see him, was very much a historical bully.
I think the essential lesson of the Mormon rebellion is that we can apply today is that you do not compromise, you do not yield to these kinds of movements, but that you stand firm against them. And if you stand firm against them, you're saying to them, truth, your truth can't prevail. It's going to have to coexist. And the more longer it coexists, the more the heat is taken out of them.
So what you're saying is that James Buchanan, he could abide by the polygamy. He could understand that that wasn't his business. He didn't really care about that.
Exactly.
The thing he couldn't brook, though, is the idea of a theocracy challenging the authority of the government.
The authority of the government and federal law. He took an oath to uphold the law and the Constitution. Now, Mormons at that time thought the Constitution was established by God through inspiration for them, so that they would have a place where there was religious freedom, where his kingdom could be restored as an earthly state and go on to prevail to universal dominion worldwide within their lifetimes. Now, this is a pretty surprising thing for us today to look at, to think that they could be doing all of this for their time. They were not doing it for you and me. They were doing it for themselves, and they were doing it at God's direct command, as in the days of Moses.
What was the timeline Brigham Young had in mind? I mean, they were, you know, more early Mormons are often called, and you call them in the book, millennials. Did he foresee ever a time when Mormons would, as they have now, adapted to the mainstream of American life?
No.
No.
It wasn't in Joseph Smith's vision. It
wasn't in Brigham Young's mind.
It's not in the church's name, the Latter-day Saints. Like the first generation of Christians, early Mormons believed they would live to see the second coming.
Yes.
That was a part of their patriarchal blessings. It was a part of the appeal of the religion, that this is the end of times and you're part of it.
So this is important context in understanding just how the intensity of the feelings at that time.
Vital Absolutely. To understand it.
Absolutely.
Vital.
It seems a major point. I need to get to a break, but it seems a major point in the book is to understand the nature of Mormon rule or Mormon governments in the early days of the church. Theocracy we're talking about. Was it just that? I mean, Joseph Smith called it a theodemocracy.
But
what was it?
But the goal of a theodemocracy was unanimous elections, and you have them in Utah. And the idea was that you wouldn't have all this political conflict, and you'd have a united people. And they actually pass laws that bring about these unanimous elections. And you might have one or two dissenting votes here and there, but everybody's name was attached to a ballot. There was no secret ballot. So they were very good at getting unanimity.
But in essence, this was a theocracy.
Sure. It's a case where everybody raises his right hand or he marks a ballot right. The Lord gives him a choice. You can do it his way or your way. If it's your way you do it, you pay the penalty. That's a free what do you call it? Free choice.
Theodemocracy.
Yeah.
David Bigler and Will Bagley are with us. They're authors of the book The Mormon Rebellion, America's First Civil War, 1857 to 1858. Tonight at 6, they'll both be on hand at Benchmark Books for a reading. Tomorrow night, they'll be at Ken Sanders Ware Books. They'll give a reading there at 7 o'clock. Both of these events, we should say, are free, open to the public, and we'll give you details about that if you go to our website at KUER.org/Radio West. You can join us if you like. Comments or questions, 801-585-WEST. Our email address, radiowest@KUER.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the Mormon Rebellion. It's the name given to the skirmish between the federal government and Mormon settlers in the Utah Territory in the early years of the church. The way the story is usually told is that in 1857, President James Buchanan sent an army to persecute the long-suffering Mormons. It's a good story, but the authors of a new book say it's not really how it happened. The book is called The Mormon Rebellion, America's First Civil War. Joining us today is Will Bagley and David Bigler, co-authors of the book. They're going to be giving readings this week, by the way, and we'll give you the details about that as we go along. I guess we should understand, David Bigler, the importance of, if you're going to understand the context of the time, the sort of intensity of the feeling of Mormons at the time, you have to understand what has come to be known as the Mormon Reformation. It was a time when Brigham Young and Mormon leaders tried to really test the strength of the faith of Mormons in 1857, around that time.
In 1855, Brigham Young announced that they were going to make a push to become either a state as a sovereign state with the independence that states had at that time, or become an independent nation by themselves. They made a big push to do that in 1856. And this was thwarted by Congress, would not approve it, because of the twin relics of barbarism, slavery and polygamy. And it was at this time that Brigham Young initiated the Reformation to really cleanse the body of Israel, to prepare for a separation, full independence from the United States, to sanctify a people. And this was introduced at a time that can only, for fearfulness, can only be compared with the Salem witch hunts of 1642.
Really clamped down.
It was a frightening time. People wept in agony of soul and spirit during this period. This is when Brigham Young introduced blood atonement. Now, in the many Mormon history books that deal with the Reformation, they say it was just a great revival, and Brigham Young never proposed the blood atonement, that some lower officials may have done so. But Brigham Young himself is quoted as proposing blood atonement.
That which is what?
The shedding of one's blood. The idea here is that Christ's sacrifice does not cover all sins. And there are some sins that are so grave that they can only be atoned by the sinner's own blood. Now, this isn't a shedding of a few drops of blood. This is a complete shedding of your blood so that you pay for the crimes with your life as in order to be saved. And Brigham Young himself says, look, I don't do this because I want to hurt people or send them ahead of their time. I do this to save them. My motive is a good one.
Now, we need to clear up that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints refutes this idea. I mean, completely, that Brigham Young somehow ordered blood atonement.
Absolutely true to refute that. That has not existed since that time. Since that time, it has not.
And he didn't order them. He simply laid out the procedures.
Which did take place, you say?
Which did take place.
Murders.
Willful. Well, they were voluntary homicides.
Yeah. I should mention that we spoke today with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. We invited them to respond to the contentions in the book. The Church Historical Department wasn't available to join us. Spokesman Scott Trotter couldn't say if church historians were aware of the book or had read the book. We've extended – you're laughing because you say they must have.
I'm laughing because Richard White, who's a very prominent Western historian, professor at Stanford, told me that when he heard – that the LDS Church was going to spend millions and millions of dollars on refuting Blood of the Prophets, which is my earlier book on Mountain Meadows, he said, what further validation could any historian hope for? And I had one of the staff members who's retired now, who worked on the project, had read Mormon Rebellion, and he complimented David and I on the introduction. He said, it's a masterpiece. And I'm sure that somebody at LDS Archives has read it, and I'm sure several people are probably reading it. And I'm convinced that my friend Rick Turley will definitely read it.
Well, we've extended the invitation for a follow-up conversation down the line on that, so I just wanted to make that clear. I wanted to ask you about one of the important elements of this idea of the intensity of feeling in the Reformation. You talk about Brigham Young and other leaders really stoked a sense of virile hostility to the American government. And not just the government. You say that they stoked a hostility to the American people themselves.
They do. They call them they denounce Christians.
They said that the murder of Joseph Smith, the prophet, was not done by a few people in Carthage, Illinois, but the whole American people are guilty of this crime. So in this sense is the sense in which they refer to all Americans.
The idea of land ownership is an important concept here. You talk about one of the central conflicts was land ownership, and you write that even the Mormon concept of planning or development, the city of Zion, was confrontational, you say hostile to outsiders. Talk about that.
Salt Lake City was first designed, laid out as a blueprint of the original city of Zion, designed in Jackson County, Missouri,
by Joseph Smith.
By Joseph Smith, yes, and it was designed in a communal fashion, because with the land ownership went a communal economic idea, and the land ownership did not square with federal laws. You have to realize that at this time in America, the nation was in the process of selling off its public lands citizens. There was this idea that good citizens are people who own land and farm their own land and are independent. And so the country was selling its land off. And under the homestead laws, the amount of land that each person is entitled to lay a claim on, preemption claim, did not fit the design of a Mormon city. And all Mormon cities at that time are patterned after the original there in Jackson County, Missouri.
And Mormons didn't get title to their land. They got stewardships. They were all controlled.
This was part of the law of consecration, so-called, at
yes.
the time.
Yeah. And it was procedure. It was practice. That you would get a stewardship, and if you took good care of it and were kept with the church, you could establish a claim to it, but only in terms of your relation with the church authorities.
But wait, so if I were non-Mormon and I moved into that territory in the 1850s, what?
Good luck.
Could I buy land? What was the story there for outsiders?
You often couldn't rent a room. You had a very hard time. You could sometimes circumvent the church, which didn't generally actively evict dissenters, people who left the faith, but it was always balanced by the fact that the church authorities themselves knew that they did not have a legitimate title. There was not a legitimate title to land in Utah until the late 1860s. So there's it's a very contentious issue because there was statements in Eastern newspapers saying the Mormons do not own a square foot of land in Utah. And we can do with it whatever we want. We can evict them, whatever.
Which was true,
yeah. But it's insulting to sure. the people who've settled the
All
land.
The land problem flows from the belief that the Lord owns the land, and he's going to come again and govern his people on it. When you see the beehive symbol on our flag and elsewhere, you see the essential idea of a Mormon community.
I have to say, I was really fascinated by the section where you write about the relationship between Mormons and Native Americans. You say that the Mormon beliefs about Indians made their neighbors in the American frontier really nervous. Talk about that.
Well, it was a double-edged sword because the Mormons' belief that they were cousins, literal blood cousins, to the Lamanites.
Based on the Book of Mormon, we should say, for
yes.
those who, yes.
Who the Lamanites, who were supposedly descended from a tribe of Israelis, and that the Mormons themselves felt that they had been lost descendants of the tribes of Ephraim. And we get this in their patriarchal blessings, but that they're literally blood of Israel, and therefore they're cousins. And that gives Mormons different attitudes towards Indians than most American settlers had. But at the same time, the Indians are always looking at what the whites are doing and trying to figure out how to live with them or get along with them somehow. But the Mormons encouraging them to get crosswise with the government doesn't play very well because the Indians essentially tell Brigham Young, when the conflict comes up, well, you guys go fight it out, and we'll see what happens.
The Indians, the doctrine, the Mormon doctrine, in keeping with what Will has just said, that made their relationship with Indians especially frightening to people on the frontier, is that the Book of Micah says that in the last days, the remnant of Jacob, which would be the Indians in Mormon minds, and people that would understand this, would go among the Gentiles and kill and tear in pieces many people. This is an Old Testament prophecy which they believed referred to their time, and their neighbors were frightened by it, and immigrants who knew about it were disturbed and fearful because of it. And the fact is that the Mormons during the war, the Mormon Rebellion, did try to enlist and encourage the Indians to take part on their side.
Let me read an email. This comes from Douglas, who writes, aren't your guests ignoring the powder keg nature of this time period? Douglas wants you to discuss the preparations for scorched earth, planned evacuation of Salt Lake City, and the Mountain Meadows Massacre right in the middle of all of this. It certainly could have turned out differently with more escalation, Douglas writes. The Branch Davidian siege stands out as a recent example of how the government will pursue easy targets. Young was just a little too far out of reach in the 1850s, as Osama bin Laden is just a little out of reach in these days. You want to respond to that?
Well, I think the book definitely captures the powder keg element, which is the name of a romantic Mormon novel, by the way, about the Utah War. But certainly we get a sense of the crisis and the sense that Brigham Young pushes everything right to the edge. And it's only when he learns that the Indian Alliance that he'd planned on, banked on, isn't going to happen. Word comes down that Indians have attacked Fort Limhi, and he immediately dispatches messengers to reverse course. He's not going to confront the army. He's going to make nice with the army. And that happens overnight. What happens overnight? Word comes down that the Indians have attacked a Mormon outpost. So we get a sense of how close this came to a real disaster. And if there had been one American soldier killed in any of these very dicey confrontations where there's actually shot sometimes exchanged, it would have been a real nasty affair with no happy endings for anybody.
Yeah. What do you mean? You think the federal government would have escalated? That could have been the end of certainly the Mormons' place in this? I mean, what's the scenario that you envision had things escalated?
But my guess is that the army would not have allowed it. They would have pushed right in, would have attacked, would have moved ahead.
And the American people would not have tolerated a disliked religious minority attacking and killing American troops.
Yep.
And the army would have gone through the Nauvoo Legion like a hot knife through butter, to use a trite phrase.
Here's an email from Pat, who writes, Hal Schindler from the Salt Lake Tribune worked on a history of the Utah War for decades. It was never published. I'm wondering if you used his research. He wants to know. You mention Hal Schindler, but you say that Hal Schindler's image of the Utah War was sort of that mythic image of the Utah War.
I think David was probably the best friend Hal Schindler had on Earth. And I used to see the two of them together, and they'd be talking about some Utah historical event, like the Bear River Massacre. And they'd be winking and nodding at each other, and they had their own secret understandings. But Hal's Utah War book, which he worked on for years and years and years, did not materialize. And I could tell some funny stories about how I laid out once the causes of the Utah War, which David laid out in Forgotten Kingdom. And I turned to Hal and I said, well, Hal, isn't that how it happened? He goes, no. I said, well, Hal, then what happened? He said, you can read about it in my book. I said, you've been telling me about this for years. Let me read what you got. I haven't written it yet. So, and Hal's research, which didn't apparently come to much, is locked in his basement at the moment. So we haven't seen it. But we did debate and talk about this stuff with Schindler for many years.
I don't believe Hal ever put pen to paper on the subject of the Utah War. And he was a very dear friend of mine, and his passing hurt me a great deal at the time, and I still hold him in the fondest memory.
David Bigler is with us, along with Will Bagley. They're co-authors of the book The Mormon Rebellion, America's First Civil War, 1857 to 1858. Tonight at 6, they're going to be at Benchmark Books for a reading there. Tomorrow night at Ken Sanders Rare Books, a reading there. For details about the events, which, by the way, are free and open to the public, go to our website, KUER.org/Radio West. We'll take another break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with the historians Will Bagley and David Bigler about their new book, A New Look at the Mormon Rebellion. That's the name of the book, The Mormon Rebellion, America's First Civil War, 1857 to 1858. So we don't have a lot of time left, and there's so many characters to get to. I want to talk about some of them on both sides of this story. Great characters, I have to say. But Will Bagley, you were saying off the air something that I wanted you to mention, that in many ways, this book is about the ordinary Mormons and the role they played in all of this.
Yes, and Mormon community spirit really reached a peak in 1857. And I've got statements by people who were later disillusioned who talk about that sense of unity and community. But it's a wonderful collection of individuals. You've got John Pack, who's down plowing his land about where the conference center is today. And a peremptory bishop comes up and takes his horse away. And he writes and complains about it and gets very, very little satisfaction. But and then people are called up out of the harvest to go up and fight the army in Echo Canyon. And many, many of these people, like Charles Derry, gives a wonderful account of how he's taken off away from his family, who are starving to death. He's put up in Echo Canyon for 6 weeks to run around in the hills and freeze. And they don't have food. They don't have clothing. And then he comes back, and they appropriate his cow to support the standing army. And when they disband the army in the spring of 1858, the Lord keeps the cow. It's hilarious stuff. There's John Bagley, who's an uncle of mine, who is the actual person who is assigned to go out and raid the army at South Pass. And all his buddies are starving to death. So what does he do? He sneaks into a federal camp, steals a 50-pound ham, carts it back 15 miles to his buddies, and after that they call him Bacon Bagley. So these are great stories. And people call me an anti-Mormon, but look, I know that I am Mormon through and through. It's my culture and background. And I have an immense respect and admiration and love for my Mormon ancestors and a deep regard for what the Mormon people accomplished in the West.
This is in the form of a testimony.
But their leaders, not so much.
David Bigler, say something, if you would, about what all of this meant. What was the impact? How did the Utah War, the so-called Utah War, or Utah Rebellion, how did it change, I guess, the direction of Mormonism?
It had a great impact on Utah, on the LDS Church, and the federal government. For example, when Brigham Young closed the trails, the immigrant trails, he virtually cut the nation in half. The Secretary of War at the time, John B. Floyd, said in arguing with Congress, asking Congress for four new regiments, he said that the Mormons Mormon settlements stand as a lion in the path of Americans' transportation and communications and immigration. The governor of California is calling for immediate federal action because they need immigration people to come in to develop their state, and they can't have this barricade there. Well, with the end of the Mormon rebellion, or it's never really over until Brigham Young died, we have 4 years later now the Civil War. And President Lincoln takes over. He's known the Mormons from when he worked in the Illinois legislature as a member. Now, if you were in his shoes as he watched the South try to take over the southwestern areas, territories, would you look at Brigham Young and this huge Mormon territory, would you take the chance of allowing them to pull that stunt again? Chances are you wouldn't, and he didn't. He ordered a volunteer regiment from California, the 3rd California Volunteers, to Utah with a cavalry component, with artillery, and they marched right up East Temple Street, that's Main Street today, to First South, and then up on the bench where we are now, and he established his fort and named it after Stephen A. Douglas That was the beginning of Fort Douglas. He trained his guns on the city below. And the gun said, it isn't time for truth to prevail quite yet. You'll have to wait a while. So that's one way. Now, another way was...
Hold on. Let me say, we got 1 minute left, and I want to give Will just a final sense of this as well.
Okay.
Tell me, Will Bagley, so how did this change the Mormon vision, of what they were to become? Did they stay millennial in their view, or did they evolve? Did they adapt based on all of this?
In many ways, the arrival of the Army is liberating. It gives the people of Utah, the common people, an alternative. It brings in a lot of money, which is a godsend to the ordinary people. It challenges Brigham Young, whose prophecies have proven false again and again and again. There's a continuing belief that the end is going to come, but there's an alternative, and that makes a big difference. And if nothing else, this is a great story, and I hope that this book, for about the first time, really presents the compelling nature of this story and its importance to both the American West and the Mormons and their heritage, which is a wonderful story.
Yeah. Quick second. You want to say something, David?
Congress moved to dismember this territory during that time and cut Utah down to the size it is now, which is over 50% smaller than it was then.
Right. Okay.
David Bigler,
you can go on forever. Will Bagley and David Bigler, thank you both very much for being with us. The Mormon Rebellion is the name of the book, America's First Civil War. They're giving readings at Benchmark Books and Ken Sanders Rare Books. Go to our website for the details. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio.